Since its identification in Brazil in May 2015, the Zika virus has spread rapidly throughout South and Central America. Although the infection appears to be mild or asymptomatic in most people, it has been linked with neurologic illnesses and congenital microcephaly. In the affected countries, the spread of the virus has reached alarming proportions. I'm Dr. Diane Kelso, Deputy Editor for CMAJ, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Derek McFadden, Infectious Diseases Physician practicing at the University Health Network in Toronto, as well as doctoral student in infectious disease epidemiology at the Harvard Chan School of Public Health in Boston. Dr. McFadden is here to tell us what we need to know about the Zika virus. He is the co-author of a practice article published in the CMAJ. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me this afternoon.
Every news outlet seems to be carrying articles on the Zika virus now. Did this virus just suddenly appear out of nowhere? Where did it come from?
So this virus actually didn't just appear out of nowhere. It was actually first identified in the late 40s in Uganda, in the Zika forest region, which is how it got its name. And then after that, there was a number of cases kind of sporadically throughout parts of Africa and Asia. And then more recently, really within the last decade, we've seen movement of the virus outside of Asia. It's caused a number of outbreaks in Pacific islands. And then that brings us to kind of really the last year. Since May of 2015, we've seen spread in South America, Central America, and now Mexico and the Caribbean, all really starting off in Brazil with the initial cases in May 2015.
Why is it spreading so rapidly, and how is it spread?
So this virus is an arbovirus, so it's an arthropod-borne virus. It's spread through a vector, the Aedes mosquito, most notably the Aedes aegypti mosquito. Now, so these mosquitoes, they bite an infected individual, and then they take in some of the blood, including the Zika virus, and then are transmitted to other individuals upon biting them. And so really, it's the spread of this virus is highly dependent upon the mosquito population. And we know that this Aedes aegypti is really distributed through really large swaths of the Americas. So there's a great potential here for significant spread of this virus. And we've seen that with the number of countries that have been involved.
Now, is there a sense that certain people are at increased risk of infection and hence of transmitting infection if bitten by a mosquito?
We know in general, the infection itself from a severity standpoint is usually fairly mild. In terms of individuals just acquiring the infection in general, probably some of the greatest risk factors are going to be proximity to breeding populations of mosquitoes. And we know that this mosquito breeds in water-filled containers, vessels, including tires and buckets. So proximity to the mosquito is going to certainly alter your risk of becoming infected or not. Certainly there are things people can do to try to avoid mosquito bites, including the clothes that they wear, long sleeve shirts, pants, using bug repellent, and definitely using mosquito nets, especially for individuals who are sleeping or not moving during daylight hours, which is when the mosquito likes to bite. In terms of severity of the infection and if there's any risk factors for having increased severity, again, it's generally, with some exceptions, including the potential fetal involvement, it's generally a pretty mild illness. There have been some reports of individuals with comorbidities having very severe disease, but it's probably more of a Zika causing a perturbation of their underlying comorbidity.
Now, you mentioned that it's a fairly mild infection, so in most. So what are the symptoms?
So the symptoms of the infection, interestingly, the most common symptom would likely be nothing, because we know the majority of individuals who are infected are, in fact, asymptomatic. For those who are symptomatic, there are fairly, I'll call them non-specific infectious symptoms, including fever, rash. Some will have arthralgias, joint pain, and conjunctivitis. But the symptoms themselves are unfortunately not great at helping us differentiate this infection from others.
So what else would be in the differential diagnosis, let's say if a patient were coming from an area where we know the Zika virus is around?
So whenever you're considering a differential from a fever in the tropics, you definitely want to first always consider things that they could have acquired elsewhere, or I call these kind of non-tropical infections. And these are kind of your run-of-the-mill community-acquired infections, which most practitioners be familiar with, you know, your respiratory tract infections, including influenza, UTI, skin and soft tissue infections. And then you want to consider the tropical infections. We always say that anybody coming back from the tropics with fever, it's prudent to rule out malaria because of the severity of infection it can cause. So we always have to have that on the differential diagnosis. Another common cause of fever from South America, Central America, Caribbean would be diarrheal diseases. But then kind of to round that out and really bring us to the focus is Zika as a possibility. And then the other two viral etiologies, which are going to look a lot like Zika. This includes chikungunya and dengue. And coincidentally enough, they're also spread by the same vector. So it's really difficult to differentiate these based on clinical symptoms alone. But you definitely need to consider all three in your differential diagnosis.
So then how would we make the diagnosis?
So the way you make the diagnosis, it depends where you are. Certainly in a lot of the involved countries in South America, Central America, Caribbean, and Mexico, they don't have laboratory diagnostics to do that. And so a lot of the presumed diagnoses are based on the syndrome. But as I noted, it can be difficult to differentiate it from dengue and chikungunya. Now, for us, there are in developed countries that have the resources, we have really two options. One is PCR-based methods, which are really work to identify the virus RNA within your blood. So you need to be in a period where you're viremic, which is typically within generally 5 to 7 days of symptom onset. However, depending upon the reference laboratory, they may do the PCR up to 10 days. The second aspect of testing is the availability of serology. And this is not really useful within the first few days after onset of symptoms because you've yet to generate an adequate antibody response. However, around 4 to 5 days after infection, then you can start to find these antibodies for Zika. And so really, you have the PCR and the serology that you can use to help you make the diagnosis. My advice for physicians generally is to talk with your local reference laboratory, which is generally the provincial labs, and they'll tell you exactly which specimens to send. And depending upon how you can note the time from infection start, then they'll send it for the appropriate testing. And these actually will end up getting sent to the NML, and the serology, for the most part, looks to be going to the CDC. But if you talk with your reference laboratory, they'll be able to tell you to help you actually send the samples.
Roughly how long does it take before the results of those tests would come back?
So it depends on the demand. For the serology, it's typically taken on the order of weeks to get the results back. The PCR will depend upon how frequently NML is running the test and the time it takes for it to get to that laboratory. So it's you're unlikely to get the diagnosis very fast. Now, that kind of brings us to treatment options and whether that impacts on treatment. And since we know that there's really no specific treatment for Zika apart from supportive care, not having that diagnosis right away probably has less impact on how you manage the patient. But certainly you do want to consider it and know whether on your differential be able to rule it out as a possible cause.
So it actually won't affect the treatment or the clinical course. What is the usual clinical course? How long will people be symptomatic with this sort of mild infection?
So the incubation period, which is the time from infection to symptom onset, varies anywhere from 2 to 12 days, roughly. Once the symptoms start, they generally last less than a week. They're typically mild, and very rarely do individuals have severe complications, although there is now this potential link to fetal neurologic complications.
So can you tell us a little bit about that aspect? Mm-hmm.
Since the start of this outbreak, there's been an observation that the cases of fetal microcephaly in involved countries seem to have increased. Now, we're dealing with still very small absolute numbers, but on a relative scale, they've potentially gone up 20-fold. And it's been hypothesized that the Zika virus could be the cause of the spike in microcephaly cases. There has been some evidence to support that. We know that the same PCR testing done on placental tissue of microcephalic infants as well as some fetal tissue has demonstrated the presence of Zika virus in a few cases. So this has supported that potential link. There was some concern initially over how the microcephaly was being classified in these involved countries. And so we don't know for sure exactly how many infants truly have microcephaly, although this is an ongoing area of research and investigation, and we're starting to get a little bit more information now. And with these same studies looking at these microcephalic infants are evaluating whether they can find further evidence of presence of the virus, which would better support the concept that Zika is causing this microcephaly.
So given that information, what should we be telling, if I have a patient who comes in, a pregnant patient or a person who's not pregnant, who's planning to travel? I mean, a lot of people have vacations booked to affected areas, you know, in the next month. Should these people be going? And if so, I mean, you've mentioned some precautions, but I guess the first question is, should they actually be going?
A lot of public health agencies and groups have put out statements regarding this. Because of this potential for fetal complications, including fetal microcephaly, most bodies have recommended that women who are or could become pregnant during their travel really should consider not going, essentially. And this, again, is related to the risk of potential risk of microcephaly. And to add to this, you know, a number of countries who have ongoing transmission have even suggested to their own citizens that they consider delaying any plans for pregnancy as well. So really, you know, in keeping with the recommendations, if you are pregnant or could become pregnant, then they should really consider avoiding travel to involved areas. Now, for other people who this doesn't apply to, the risks of Zika virus are fairly low. And so there's no advisories with respect to travel for them. There are certain things you can do to try to prevent mosquito bites and thus help prevent acquiring the virus. And those are, you know, pretty simple things. But wearing pants, long sleeve shirts, using mosquito repellent, and also using bug nets.
So if I had a pregnant patient of mine or a person who got a woman who got pregnant on her vacation in one of these areas, she comes back with a fever. Yeah. You mentioned already that obviously it takes a long time for the Zika results to come back, serology or PCR results to come back. But would this be a case in which I would definitely want to send off some specimens?
Absolutely. You know, if you have a patient who was pregnant or became pregnant while in an involved country, then I would definitely further evaluate this patient. Now, there have been some actually interim guidelines released by the CDC on how to evaluate these patients. They're somewhat complicated, but I would definitely recommend that if whoever's in this scenario consults these interim guidelines. What it boils down to is both assessing whether the individual has had evidence of Zika infection, and then also assessing fetal health, and fetal neurologic status, which is typically done through fetal ultrasound. Now, these are guidelines that are available online through the CDC, but definitely anybody who's been there and was pregnant or became pregnant while there should be further evaluated.
So just one last question. Obviously, the early days yet, but is there a vaccine in the works for this?
So unfortunately, there hasn't been any vaccines at advanced stages of study to date. This was kind of more in contrast to the Ebola vaccine. So there's really nothing that we can readily try to use right now. Now, there have been vaccines in the works for dengue and West Nile virus, and some have been developed. And so because they belong to the same family of virus, it's hopeful that they may be able to apply the same techniques to develop a Zika virus vaccine. And the NIH has highlighted this, NIH in the U.S. has highlighted this as a major focus for them. However, admittedly, to actually get to a point where they would have a viable vaccine for use on a large scale is going to take years, really. So it's unlikely that a vaccine will be developed and become available to impact on the current outbreak that's occurring. The other point I would raise is that this is just related to preparation for travel. In addition to the consideration about Zika and especially around pregnant or women who could become pregnant, I would just want to remind people that a lot of these countries that have Zika also have other potentially dangerous infections, including malaria, and that getting free travel consultation, free travel advice from a physician is important for a lot of these patients to make sure that they're protected from not only Zika virus, but also a number of the other possible infections that they could acquire when traveling.
A very important point. Thanks so much, Derek, for joining me.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
I've been speaking with Dr. Derek McFadden. To read the practice article he co-authored, visit cmaj.ca.